Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we're going to have two very special guests talking about the future. In the first half of Exploration, we're going to bring on Michael Marriott, Executive Director of NIRS, the Nuclear Information Resource Service, talking about the future of energy, specifically nuclear energy. And then in the second half of Exploration, we're also going to talk about the future of, well, beauty. We're going to bring on Dr. John Connolly, one of the nation's leading experts on cosmetic surgery. What about the science behind cosmetic surgery? Now that so many baby boomers are reaching for the knife, what about the downside and what about the benefits concerning beauty and enhancement on the operating table? Well, first of all, President Barack Obama revealed a monumental plan to reorganize the United States of America. Not since the days of Franklin Roosevelt has a president initiated such a huge budget that will affect the entire direction of the country, literally for generations to come. But the question is, will Barack Obama be remembered as a Hoover, a man who didn't do enough, or as an FDR, which led us out of the wilderness and literally turned the political landscape of the United States upside down for the next 30, 40 years? Well, first of all, of course, we know that the economy is in a mess. A tremendous economic mess, a downturn that we haven't seen since the Great Depression back in the 1930s. And the economic stimulus package, well, is it really a stimulus package, or is there a lot of pork barrel in the plan being proposed by President Barack Obama? Specifically, we're going to look at energy, in particular, nuclear energy. But unfortunately, an explicit plan for the future of nuclear energy is missing in Obama's plan. So in other words, we can't really say what's going to happen with energy, specifically nuclear energy. So once again, we're going to bring on our first special guest. The interview was taped actually in the last days of the Bush administration, but we simply don't know what President Barack Obama's position on nuclear energy is going to be. So we're going to bring on Michael Marriott, Executive Director of NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service. The first question for you, Michael, is what precisely is NIRS?
Well, NIRS is Nuclear Information and Resource Service, a slightly awkward name with a very precise and important mission. We serve essentially as a clearinghouse, the center of the grassroots environmental and safe energy movement, that part concerned with nuclear powers, sustainable energy, radioactive waste. Both in the United States and across the world. We have offices in, we have 12 offices on four continents right now. And we campaign on nuclear issues, and we support grassroots groups across the world.
And you're also part of the WISE network, which is international, right?
That's right. NIRS WISE have a joint affiliation agreement. And basically, we have, you know, sort of two headquarters offices, one here in Washington and one in Amsterdam, and we work very closely together.
Okay, well, let's get right to the substance of the interview, which is that some environmentalists are saying that because of the overwhelming problem of global warming, which threatens our very way of life and civilization, that nuclear power, well, we have to take a second look at it because it doesn't emit that much greenhouse gases. And a billion people saw Al Gore at the Oscars, and An Inconvenient Truth is now part of our vocabulary. And environmentalists, some of them are coming out and saying, well, if we're part of the mainstream now, let's take a new look at nuclear energy. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, we are in full agreement that the climate crisis is the most pressing environmental issue of our time. It may be the most pressing issue of any kind confronting the Earth right now. And it is precisely for that reason that we cannot afford to go the nuclear route. And this is because nuclear power is counterproductive at our ability, at our nation's ability, at our planet's ability to effectively combat the greenhouse effect and slow down global warming. And this is because, for several reasons. First of all, nuclear power is not a carbon-free source of energy, despite how the nuclear industry likes to portray it. This is because while the reactors themselves, the generators of electricity, are essentially carbon-free, the nuclear fuel chain is not. It takes vast amounts of fossil fuels to mine uranium, process it, enrich it, create the fuel, build the facilities, and then take care of the waste for the next many millions of years. And so when you add it all up, the contribution nuclear power can make in reducing carbon emissions is much lower than it might seem on the surface. When you add to that the enormous amount of resources it takes to build and operate reactors and the accompanying fuel chain, for nuclear power to play any kind of meaningful role, and by meaningful I mean relatively small but at least measurable role, would require the construction of anywhere from 800 to, I've heard estimates as high as 4,000 new reactors across the globe. That would total in the trillions and trillions of dollars, which is money that could far better and must be spent if we are to deal with climate and effectively reduce carbon emissions on those sources of energy that actually are carbon-free. For that kind of money, that kind of nuclear program, we're talking about a 20% reduction of carbon emissions. We need to get to an 80% reduction of carbon emissions. Nuclear power cannot get us there.
Okay, well, let's look at some of the arguments for nuclear energy. The pro-nuclear industry says that look at the defections within the environmental movement. Here is a former founder of Greenpeace who says, yes, the greenhouse effect is so awful that we have to go nuclear. Also, James Lovecock is saying, well, let's take a look at this, given the fact that the Earth itself is being threatened, and he is the one of the founders of the Gaia hypothesis. So
well,
what are your thoughts?
Well, there's a lot of mythology here. First of all, when people talk about environmentalists rethinking nuclear power, these same two names and one or two others are the only ones that ever come up. If you look at the positions of environmental groups across the country, across the world, there are no recognized environmental groups that are in favor of nuclear power. There are degrees of opposition, but there's nobody out there saying, let's build more plants. What you have instead is in the case of Patrick Moore, who actually was not a founder of Greenpeace. In fact, it was revealed yesterday in a Vermont newspaper that somebody found his application to join Greenpeace, his application to work at Greenpeace, which he filed. And you don't apply for a position if you were a founder. But he was certainly a significant person in Greenpeace until 1986. That was over 20 years ago. For the past 20 years, he has been consulting with industry, and he is now a paid lobbyist for the Nuclear Energy Institute, which is the nuclear energy's trade organization. He is not an unbiased person. He's being paid to say what he is saying. And I would argue that his environmental credentials are long past. In the case of James Lovelock, I respect James quite a lot in the Gaia hypothesis. However, he is not expert in all things, and he is not expert in nuclear issues. I mean, this is a guy who publicly said he wouldn't mind having a high-level radioactive waste dump on his farm. To be able to say that shows a complete ignorance of the potential hazards of high-level radioactive waste. He doesn't understand them. Doesn't mean he's not right on a lot of other things, but he has not, he is not a nuclear expert. He's not a radiation expert, and he should really, in this case, stick to what he does know.
Okay, and what do you say to people who say that the greenhouse effect is so awful, just absolutely so awful, that even though nuclear has lots of warts, Even the nuclear has lots of problems. Yes, yes. I mean, that's a matter of public record. We have to look at all energy sources, including nuclear. What do you say?
Well, again, I would go back to the fact that it's actually counterproductive. It makes things worse, not better, in terms of tying up our resources so that we can't effectively address climate change. But I would also add to that that it's a false hypothesis. It's an either or. Yes, we need to deal with the climate crisis. We are, we are part of a number of coalitions that deal with the climate crisis, and we're very adamant and passionate about that. But these are not the only two choices out there. In fact, if we're going to deal effectively with climate, we're going to have to vastly increase energy efficiency. It can be done. Just for a very quick example, the United States is half as energy efficient as Western Europe, which is half as energy efficient as Japan. And other countries, particularly Eastern Europe and other industrialized countries, are worse than the U.S. So there's huge gains to be made worldwide in energy efficiency and reducing emissions. We also have to turn toward and really do what I would argue a Marshall Plan level of activity on developing and particularly implementing renewable energy sources. I mean, the sources are out there. There are buildings in northern New England and northern Germany that run entirely on solar power. It can be done. What needs to happen is the mass production of it to go into effect so that the cost becomes more reasonable. That will happen with mass production. That will happen with resources put into this. It's not going to happen if we're putting billions and trillions of dollars into nuclear reactors that provide a lot less help toward alleviating the climate crisis.
Okay, well, let's say we do build thousands and thousands of new reactors. Some people say they are sitting ducks for a 9/11 terrorist attack. And just last month, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission issued a rather controversial statement stating that reactors do not have to be retrofitted in order to meet the demands of a 9/11 terrorist attack. So do you think, therefore, that we would be creating thousands of sitting ducks for terrorist attacks?
Well, security and terrorism have been a shortcoming of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in particular for quite a long time. My first article on this was back in 1988 when I wrote that any country that has nuclear power plants within its borders is, in effect, creating a nuclear weapons capability for any country that wants to attack it. That remains true today. Security is evident at nuclear power plants, but it is woefully inadequate. And you can see that very clearly by a couple of things that have happened. First off, ironically, on September 11th, 2001, the NRC dismissed a case involving a facility in the southeast, I believe it was Georgia, where the security terrorism issue had been brought up, and they dismissed it from the proceedings, saying that a terrorist attack on the United States was so improbable that it didn't need to be considered. I assume they regretted saying that afterwards, but that was their official position. We now know that the people involved in 9/11 did at one point actually consider taking one of those planes to a nuclear power plant, specifically Indian Point, just outside of New York City. They discussed that. For whatever reason, they decided not to, but it was on their minds. And what the NRC has done, and I'm a little bit at a disadvantage here because the NRC has classified most of this stuff. I know how many people the nuclear utilities are required to protect against in their exercises and in their legal requirements. I'm not allowed to tell you how many they are, but I will tell you that it is less than 19. And 19 is the number, that, of course, that participated in 9/11. What the NRC did most recently was reject some relatively simple improvements that could be made around existing plants to make an airplane attack on a nuclear facility virtually meaningless. And this would be putting basically some steel beams around the reactor so that a plane would break up before it ever hit the plant. Relatively inexpensive, not free, but relatively inexpensive, very protective. But of course, airplanes are not the only way, they're not the only security threat to a nuclear reactor, and the history of the regulatory agencies is that they just don't take it seriously.
Okay, now also the industry is saying that they're about to put online a new generation of nuclear power plants, which are safer. They learned their lesson from Chernobyl, they say. They learned their lesson from Three Mile Island. These reactors would be based on small little pebbles, perhaps gas-cooled, and a reactor accident like Three Mile Island would not take place within a matter of minutes. It would take days for a meltdown to take place. So what are your thoughts about the so-called new generation of nuclear power plants?
Well, the first problem is that they don't exist, at least not in any kind of commercially ready situation. And in fact, none of the reactors that are being proposed for the U.S., and there are about 30 to 32 reactors, new reactors for the U.S. that are being discussed, and none of them have actually applied for a formal license yet, but they're on the table publicly at least. Not a single one of these is of this type of design. What they are instead is what are called evolutionary designs. They're similar to the existing reactors, but with some improvements. We'll acknowledge that they're improvements, but they're not fail-safe by any means. Then you get to the what you've described as the pebble bed reactors. There is one of those that they are trying to build in South Africa. There's a lot of opposition in South Africa to this. We have an office there and are working on that. And the pebble bed has some clear advantages to the current generation, the current type of design, but it also has some disadvantages. Without going into all of them, the key disadvantage is that it uses a passive air-cooled system rather than the water-cooled of the existing reactors. And the problem with that is that to ensure that the air reaches and cools, there are no containment buildings. It cannot have a containment building. It cannot be built underground. And when you put that together with your previous question about security and terrorism, well, there is nothing that is a less secure and more amenable to terrorist threat than a nuclear reactor without a containment building.
And even though a reactor meltdown takes longer with these new reactors, they still take place, don't they? I mean, you can still melt one of these reactors.
Well, you can, and one a predecessor, a test version in Germany, actually did have a very serious accident in 1986. They tried to cover it up by saying the radiation that came from it was actually Chernobyl radiation, but finally had to admit that, yes, they'd had a serious accident there. It was a small reactor, but it did happen. Another problem with these reactors is routine releases would be higher than with the existing reactors. Most people don't realize that all nuclear reactors release radiation on a routine basis. They have to in order to operate. They vent it into the air, they vent it into the water, and people who live near reactors receive this radiation. Normal operations, hopefully it's quite low levels, but it is there, it exists. A pebble bed reactor uses hundreds of thousands of tiny little pebbles, little fuel pellets, as its fuel. And it's impossible to manufacture that many pellets without some of them being somewhat faulty. I mean, unless you have a 100% perfect rejection rate in the manufacture of the fuel. And as far as I know, no manufacturing process has ever been 100% perfect. When those little pebbles get into that reactor and it's like a crack or something, the radiation from the faulty pebbles will go out, and because there's no containment, it's going to go into the environment. In a normal reactor, if that happened, hopefully the containment would keep that radiation inside. Doesn't always work, and there have been cases where it hasn't already. But in this type of reactor with no containment, you're going to get higher than normal routine releases. So it doesn't take an accident to release radiation under these type of reactors. The neighbors are going to be getting higher doses.
Okay, now let's also talk about the proliferation problem. It used to be stated that there was a great wall that separates commercial and military reactors, and that was the fundamental basis for Atoms for Peace. But now the Iranians are reaching for weapons technology using commercially available technology, and they're saying that we followed the rules. We obeyed all the rules, we signed all the treaties, and now you won't let us have these reactors, which can be used for military purposes. So what about what happens when we have thousands of reactors beyond what we have now with the proliferation danger?
Well, there's actually two sides of this issue, and they're both quite threatening, unfortunately. One is the enrichment of uranium. And uranium, whether it is used in a nuclear reactor or for a nuclear weapon, is first enriched. And the only difference, it's enriched in the same type of facility. In either case, the only difference is how enriched it becomes. For a nuclear reactor, a commercial reactor, you enrich it up to about 5%. For a weapon, you enrich it up to, you know, 80% or more. But the process is the same. It just goes through the process longer to create weapons-grade uranium. And so what has happened in Iran, as happened earlier in Pakistan, in India, in North Korea, and elsewhere, is that because of a particular individual plans for the Urenco style, Urenco is a European company, enrichment plant, have been delivered all over the world. They're spread all over the world, and these countries are building and have built uranium enrichment plants. They can say, if they want, that these are for peaceful purposes, because if you want to have a nuclear power program in your country and you don't want to be reliant on another country for fuel for that, you're going to have one of these plants. The problem is you're also going to have one of these plants if you want to make nuclear weapons. And that's where the suspicion comes in, of course. But it's really the height of hypocrisy, I believe, for the United States to be telling countries like Iran, well, you can't have uranium enrichment facilities, even while we are building new uranium enrichment facilities. I would prefer rather that nobody be building new uranium enrichment facilities. So there's that aspect of it. Then when you have the reactors, each reactor produces a large amount of plutonium. Every commercial reactor produces plutonium as part of its normal operation, and this plutonium that is produced in commercial reactors used only for electricity can then, if the country has the technology, and the technology is more difficult than enrichment, but it is within grasp of a lot of countries, they can then separate that plutonium out, and they can use that for nuclear weapons, and they can create hydrogen bombs. Obviously, if you are talking about a worldwide effort to build hundreds to thousands of new reactors, you need dozens of new uranium enrichment plants around the world, and you are producing, you know, far more plutonium than it ever has been produced. And in addition, and this is something that doesn't come out very much, the world supply of usable uranium, accessible, mineable uranium that is of high enough quality to use in a enrichment process is not unlimited. In fact, it is limited. There are various estimates as to how much there is out there, but there is general agreement that if we had a couple thousand reactors, there would not be enough. There would be enough uranium to power them for only probably a decade or two, maybe three, before you would have to go to reprocessing. And when you reprocess, then basically what you're doing is making plutonium a commodity. And once plutonium becomes a commodity, once everybody has access to plutonium, you know, the jig is up, and every country will become a nuclear weapons-capable country.
Okay, now let's also talk about the issue of nuclear waste, which is, of course, one of the focal points of NIRS. Some people say that the Yucca Mountains facility outside Las Vegas may never open up, and we're going to be stuck with all these reactors where with no place to put the waste.
Well, the proposed Yucca Mountain facility is just a complete disaster. We have spent billions of dollars examining this facility and testing it, and it is probably, you know, the most examined piece of real estate in the world. It is the only place in the world that we know definitively is unsuitable for nuclear waste disposal, for seismic reasons, for just, you know, all kinds of reasons. It's just absolutely unsuitable. The state of Nevada has fought tooth and nail against this project for about 20 years now, and shows no sign of abating. The Senate Majority Leader is Senator Harry Reid of Nevada, who has been an absolute opponent of Yucca Mountain for just as long, and will be doing everything in his power to end this program during his tenure. And, you know, things have just gotten so bad that even a nuclear regulatory commissioner who's retiring on his verge of retirement, Ed McGaffigan, who is the longest serving nuclear regulatory commissioner in history. And yet he came out last month and said we should give up on the Yucca Mountain program.
And that concludes the interview with Michael Marriott, who is the executive director of NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service, in Washington, D.C., and their website is nirs.org. Well, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on a doctor, Dr. John Connolly, one of the nation's leading experts on plastic surgery. With so many baby boomers hitting 60, there's been a rush to go underneath the knife, and the question is, how safe is it? And also, if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And also, you may want to get a copy of my latest book. It's called Physics of the Impossible. And if you've been watching all the summer blockbusters, you kind of wonder, well, are any of those gadgets from science fiction really possible? Invisibility, teleportation, ray guns, time travel. Find out by getting a copy of Physics of the Impossible. So stay tuned for the second half of Exploration. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we introduced Michael Marriott. He's Executive Director of NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service, asking the question, will nuclear power save us from the greenhouse effect? And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to shift gears a bit and ask another question. Will plastic surgery save us from the aging process? Well, as most of you know, the baby boomers are now hitting 60, and the baby boomers have been pampered all their life. Every time there was a problem, they would simply pop a pill or do whatever it takes to get rid of that problem. But now we're talking about the ravages of the aging process, and many people are now reaching for the knife, that is, plastic surgery. There have been a number of reality programs featuring the extreme makeovers that certain people undergo. And the question is, well, how safe and how effective are these treatments? I mean, what about the science behind these things? And our special guest in the second half of Exploration is Dr. John Connolly. In fact, he's one of the nation's leading respected authorities on plastic surgery. So once again, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about the safety of plastic surgery. How safe is it? How effective? And most of all, does it really work the way it's supposed to? Well, today we have with us Dr. John J. Connolly. He's the author of a book called America's Cosmetic Doctors and Dentists, and it is perhaps the most authoritative book on the market talking about the real implications of plastic surgery. I mean, after all, we are talking about cutting up the body. We're talking about anesthesia, the possibility of bleeding, complications. And so once again, today we are talking about a more balanced point of view concerning the pros and the cons of cosmetic surgery. Dr. Connolly, the first question for you is, as a child, how did you first get interested in science and medicine, and why did you decide to pursue a career in this subject?
Well, interestingly, it actually happened in that order. I originally started out as a science major undergraduate in college in physics and chemistry, and I was interested in the field. And I first went into teaching, and my early career was in education, and I went on and I became a college president when I was 31 years old. I earned a doctorate in college and university administration from Columbia, and that was my field. And I got involved on the board of New York Medical College. And in 1981, I became president of New York Medical College. I'd been very involved in healthcare, and on an avocational level, I was chairman of a hospital board and involved in a number of other healthcare activities. And once I became president of the medical school, my career really changed from education to healthcare because of all the hospital affiliations, of the research emphasis, teaching was just one small part of a medical school. And that was the transition. So for the last 25 years of my career, I've been involved in healthcare.
Okay. And specifically, why did you decide to write the book, America's Cosmetic Doctors and Dentists, and how did you get interested in the whole field of cosmetic surgery?
Well, I had been president of the medical school for over 10 years and a college president for over 20 altogether, and I decided I wanted to do something different. The chairman of the board of the medical school, John Castle, who is now my partner, when I told him I wanted to make a change and do something different, he suggested that we publish books to help people find the best health care. Because when you're involved at a medical school or a hospital, so many people ask you for advice on finding the right doctors or the right hospital. And he thought that if our friends and associates needed that kind of assistance, other people did as well. So we founded Castle Connolly Medical Limited in 1992 and began publishing books to help people find the best health care. That's the mission of our company. And our first book was Top Doctors New York, and we did America's Top Doctors. But then because of all of the problems occurring in the cosmetic field where people getting treated by untrained, I don't even want to say professionals, some of them professionals but others not, but all kinds of disasters occurring, everything from, you know, disfiguration to death, we felt there was really a need for a book to help people identify qualified cosmetic physicians and dentists instead of going to people who were not qualified. So that's why we published that book.
And I must recommend America's Cosmetic Doctors and Dentists for anyone who wants to get a balanced look at the entire field. Well, let's talk about the resurgence of interest in this whole area. We are inundated with TV specials, TV programs like The Swan, Dr. 90210, Extreme Makeover. We see people being transformed literally right before our eyes, and it seems so quick and easy. It sounds like taking two aspirin pills, and all of a sudden you can become beautiful and correct any kind of physical defect. Well, first of all, let's talk about the interest. How many procedures are performed per year, and do you see an explosion taking place given the fact that baby boomers are pushing 50?
Yes, there's no question that the growth has been tremendous. There are about 12 million procedures a year, both surgical and non-surgical cosmetic procedures performed just in the U.S. And, of course, that includes the surgery things like facelifts and nose jobs and breast enhancements, and the non-surgical things like Botox and chemical peels and hair transplants and all of that. And it's growing very rapidly. It's growing not only among women but among men. And it's growing at both ends of the age spectrum as well, younger people as well as older people undertaking some kind of cosmetic procedure.
And what percent of that huge number are satisfied, and what percent of that large number are not so satisfied with the results of cosmetic surgery?
Well, we surveyed the physicians in our book, America's Cosmetic Doctors and Dentists, and there were over 6,000 who are listed in the book, and we asked them what percentage of the patients they see are coming back to them because they're not happy, and the range was around somewhere between 12 to 15%. Now, if it's 12 to 15% coming, actually going back to another doctor to say, can you correct this, I have to guess that you'd have to add at least another 5 or 10% to that. People who are not happy with the outcome but not bothering to go seek another doctor. So our estimates based on that survey is somewhere between 15 and 25% are unhappy with the outcome of their procedures.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes we forget the procedures like liposuction, which people mention at cocktail parties, is real surgery, and that there were two very well-publicized deaths in New York City that took place, I think, at Manhattan Eye and Ear Clinic, a very well-respected hospital. But two women died under very mysterious circumstances. What are your thoughts about that incident?
Well, Professor, I think the first point you made is really a critical one, and that is that many of these are real surgical procedures. I mean, this is not just going in and having, a blemish on your skin removed. Liposuction, for example, that you mentioned specifically, is a very serious procedure. And the death rate for liposuction, by the way, is much higher than it is for other major surgical procedures. And the reason is because there are a lot of untrained people doing it. In terms of the deaths that you mentioned at Manhattan Eye and Ear, they were very unfortunate because, as you said, it is a well-known and well-respected hospital. It's been a major place for cosmetic surgery over the years, and both deaths were related to anesthesia. And it's still not completely understood why, except it's clear that both women had related health problems, and it was questionable about the supervision and the administration of the anesthesia as well. They were anesthesia deaths, however, and not anything to do with the surgery itself. In fact, they never got to the surgery. And that raises a very important point, that one of the major risks in any kind of cosmetic procedure is the anesthesia, and you have to be especially careful. And if it's any kind of a major procedure, you really should make certain it's done either in a hospital or in a fully accredited ambulatory surgical facility, one that's prepared to deal with all kinds of emergencies.
Okay, well, in your book, you have a chapter saying that we have to do our homework before we undergo these procedures. For example, we have to check the doctor's credentials. And we also have to psychologically be prepared to have a realistic expectations that we're not going to instantly turn into Cinderella as a consequence of this. Could you elaborate some of the psychological and also some of the homework preparation that people have to do?
Yes, and let's start with the psychological. We see these TV shows, The Extreme Makeover, The Swan, and these huge dramatic improvements in people. And I think, actually, I have to say, even though those shows are a little hokey, I have to say the changes are spectacular for a lot of the people that they have on those shows. And I think it can really change their lives. But most of us are not looking for that kind of dramatic makeover. We're looking for a little improvement here, a little improvement there, get our chin tightened up or bags from under our eyes or something else or, liposuction to get something off the love handles around our waist. And so we're not looking for these dramatic changes, but we're looking for modest improvement. And that's, I think, the appropriate attitude, because the dramatic changes are extremely expensive, a lot of risk, a lot of time, and a lot of money. And I don't think for most people they're a realistic attainment. The preparation and finding the right physician or dentist is so critical, because what people don't realize, Professor, is that once a physician is licensed, they can call themselves any kind of a specialist they want, perfectly legally in any state in this country, which means you could be trained as a psychiatrist, and tomorrow you could go out and hang up a sign and say you're a cosmetic surgeon, and there is nothing illegal about that. There is no state agency, no federal agency, not the medical profession. Nobody stops it, because the practice of medicine is unrestricted. Once you have a license, you can call yourself any kind of a specialist you want. And since there are only four or five specialties that really have training in cosmetic surgery, you really have to make certain that any physician is board certified in an appropriate specialty. And those appropriate specialties include plastic surgeons who can be trained to do plastic surgery or cosmetic surgery over the whole body. Otolaryngologists, and they can be trained, but only some of them are trained appropriately, to do surgery of the face. Oral maxillofacial surgeons, which is actually a dental specialty, they can be trained to do surgery of the face as well. Dermatologists, who do obviously cosmetic treatments of the skin, and some of them are trained to do surgery. And then lastly, ophthalmologists who may do blepharoplasties, eye lifts. But other than that, physicians and no other specialty have any training in cosmetic surgery unless they've gone out and been trained somewhere. And you really have to be able to look into that to be sure they know what they're doing.
And I understand that in Manhattan, a lot of dentists are saying that they're not making much income, so they supplement it by creating a spa. A spa where you can get a facial, you can get Botox, you can get all sorts of things, and have your teeth cleaned at the same time.
That's happening, and I even ran into a woman at a function I was talking to about our book, and she told me that at her hairdresser's, somebody was walking around with a tray full of syringes and needles offering to give Botox injections at the hairdresser's. So, many people are looking at this much too lightly, and, they think, oh, well, a little Botox won't hurt. Well, the fact is, even though Botox generally works very well, someone can administer it improperly, and it can create certain problems. The good thing is it'll go away after a few months, but it can be a problem.
Okay, well, let's now get right into some of the procedures that you mention in your book, America's Cosmetic Doctors and Dentists, leading off with Botox, but let's talk about complications as well. Let's talk about the procedure, its benefits, and of course, a majority of people do seem to be satisfied with these procedures, but complications such as bleeding or infection or disfigurement or even death. So let's start off with Botox. What is it, and what are some of the perils?
Well, I think Botox is botulism. Botulism itself is poisonous, but when Botox, which is a trademark name, is used as a drug for injections, it's obviously modified, and it's very safe. The worst thing that can happen for unfortunately or fortunately, is that sometimes it can be given, somebody can be given too much Botox, and the result will be that they will have a frozen look on their face, so they won't be able to move certain facial muscles. The good thing about it is that it wears off after a while, so it won't be permanent. And over 2.5 million people every year are getting Botox injections, and it's growing at the rate of 25% a year.
And are there complications? For example, if you have one at a cocktail party, how clean is that needle?
Well, that's another issue. Clearly, there was somebody out in the Bronx in New York who they weren't even physicians, they weren't trained, and they were administering something that wasn't even Botox. But I think if you go to a qualified physician, a dermatologist, for example, a plastic surgeon, you get Botox administered, the risks are very low, and the worst outcome, as I said, is not going to be infection. I mean, if you go to somebody who's untrained in some walk-in clinic somewhere, well, for any procedure, whether it's Botox or anything else, you're taking a great risk. But if you go to the right, properly trained person, there's very little risk with Botox.
And, of course, Botox is an organic chemical. It is a poison, as you mentioned, that's been diluted tremendously. But that means that it's going to be metabolized and absorbed by the body. So don't you have to go back every few months?
Well, you do. Botox is not a permanent solution to anything. It can remove wrinkles, and basically it does it by relaxing the facial muscles. But it's not permanent, and you have to go back every few months. And it can be pretty expensive as well. So it's popular, and I think it's popular with a lot of patients because it only takes a few minutes and there's no high risk and it does work. It's also popular with physicians because you have to keep going back and getting them every few months.
Okay, now let's switch to liposuction, which we hinted at before. Precisely what is involved with removing large quantities of fat? And, of course, on these TV specials, we see quarts of the stuff being taken out. And you kind of wonder, oh, my God, is the body going to be able to adjust to that large a mass taken out? But what is liposuction, and what are some of the perils that we hinted at before?
Well, Professor, that's the key. It is a lot of fat being taken out, and it can be quarts, and that's where the risk comes in. But liposuction is basically a procedure. And I remember when I first saw it back in the 80s, I mean, I was with a group of physicians, alumni of New York Medical College, and one of our alumni was making a presentation to us on that, and we could hardly believe it. It was basically they insert a cannula, which is a tube that has very powerful suction and a very sharp point and ends, and basically they stick it into the fat and they jab it around and break up the fat tissue, and it's sucked out. And along with the fat, there's a lot of fluid, there's a lot of blood, and that's where the risk comes in. If it's a small amount of liposuction, a little bit around the waist or maybe, under the chin or something very light, there's not a high risk. But when you start doing large volume and removing quarts of it, the risk can be very substantial, and it should only be done in a hospital or an accredited ambulatory surgical facility. And the major risk are that in any surgery with the loss of blood and fluid, there can be chemical imbalances in the body, throws people into shock, and that's kind of a problem with liposuction. Plus, a lot of it demands, complete total anesthesia where you're put under, and that has its risk as well. So liposuction, even though it is the number one surgical procedure with almost 500,000 people a year undergoing liposuction, there's a lot of risk associated with it, and you have to really make sure not only do you have a board-certified physician doing it, a plastic surgeon, preferably, or if it's around the face, maybe a cosmetic dermatologist, someone who's been trained, surgical dermatologist. But you really have to make sure that even if it's a plastic surgeon, that they've had training in liposuction because it is a high-risk procedure.
And a few years ago in New York, there was a well-publicized case of a poor Latin woman who went to a doctor who was really not a doctor at all. She took out a lot of fat from the stomach and put it into her rear. So instead of using collagen to build up areas, the doctor was basically rearranging the fat, and the woman died. In fact, this person killed, I think, several women as a consequence.
And that can happen. Again, if you're going to have liposuction, you really have to check out the position and the facility as well. And that kind of thing is not uncommon, by the way. Interesting with liposuction, it can be very positive because liposuction actually takes out the fat cells, which means if you start to put on weight, you tend not to put it on in the same place simply because there aren't fat cells there to hold the fat. You've actually taken out those fat cells. So you may put on weight, may put it on in other places.
Okay. And also, what happens if you have complications like diabetes or pre-existing conditions? Doesn't that mean that you should probably stay away from these more drastic procedures?
It really depends on your health. I think the major issue is not just diabetes, but if you have heart disease, this is where the risk comes in for so many people with anesthesia. I mean, you have to be, if you're going to undergo surgery, any kind of surgery, and of course all of this is elective, it's voluntary, you don't have to do it, but any kind of surgery, you have to make sure that your ticker's in good working order, or if you do have diabetes or other related problems, that the procedure you're undergoing, that the physician can manage all of that.
Okay, now let's move to facelifts, which of course involve many different kinds of procedures. But, Joan Rivers was interviewed on TV the other day, and she said that, well, everyone should have a facelift every 2 years. And so people are talking about it as if it's just like, you know, taking an aspirin and what's the big deal, right? What about facelifts? Are there complications? Or what about the possibility of disfigurement? Because after all, these doctors are not artists when they rearrange somebody's face.
Well, actually, Joan looks pretty good. I saw her the other day at Grand Central. She was doing Grand Central Station. She was doing some interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I think her belly button might be up around her neck at this point because she's had so much work done.
And so much pulling on the face, right? That
yes.
Your face gets stretched.
And I don't know about every 2 years, but clearly if someone has a facelift, and facelifts tend to be low risk, except for the anesthesia, I've not heard of anybody bleeding to death because of a facelift or going into shock because of so much blood and fluid loss. The anesthesia would be the major risk there. And many people actually have less than a facelift. A facelift, about 150,000 people in this country every year have a full facelift. But, they're almost 300,000 that have eyelid surgery and have, take bags out around the eyes. And another 175,000 that have rhinoplasties, nose jobs. It's about 150,000 that do the full facelift. And they've developed a number of techniques these days that are more modest. Some of them are just kind of minor surgical. It's inserting very small threads or pins in that kind of lift the face and achieve the same goal. And the good thing about facelifts is you don't need one every 2 years. If you have a facelift, if it makes you look 10 years younger, you'll look 10 years younger as you grow older. You'll just look younger as you grow older. And I think if you have a facelift every 2 years, you'll end up looking like Michael Jackson or somebody. And, of course, none of us want that.
Okay. And also, doesn't it change the facial expressions? Like when you see these aging actresses on television and you watch them talk, you know they're in their 60s, and yet their brows don't move at all. It's as if they have a mask on. But they do look considerably younger than being in their 60s.
I think that can certainly be one of the outcomes. That can also be an outcome of simply an eye job, a blepharoplasty, because we don't realize that the eyes are really the mirror of our face and our soul and all, and they're so expressive. And many people have these eye jobs, and they lose all expression around the eyes and the forehead, and they do look like that. On the other hand, these days, the really good surgeons, you don't get that mask-like appearance that you got 20 years ago or 25 years ago. They're much more subtle. They don't reach for so much. They do a better job. And although you can, in many cases, detect it, in many others you can't if it's done really well.
Okay, let's also talk about breast augmentation, specifically whether or not silicone or saline solutions or better? What about the long-term hazards of these things? And what about the operation itself?
Well, there are over 330,000 women a year who have their breasts augmented. And, you know, in this country, we use the saline solution. Silicone is actually coming back in Europe as an implant. And there, you know, there was all that flap years ago about the safety of it. And long term, no one has really demonstrated that silicone does cause a problem. And apparently many surgeons believe and many patients believe that it's a better material for an implant than the saline solutions that we use today. The major risks there, again, are anesthesia, although certainly a breast lift doesn't have major bleeding and blood loss. It has some. And the real concern with women who have it done is the scarring, and make sure the scars are very subtle and very well hidden in folds of skin and elsewhere so that they're not visible. And I think the techniques for breast lifts today, in our book, we also have a lot of before and after photos. And if you look at those, you'll see, I mean, I think they really achieve spectacular results on them. And, you know, the other side of the coin that we don't talk about often, but it's there, two different aspects related to that. One is that breast reduction is a major thing. Far fewer women have it. It's not even, among the top five procedures. But it can be a very wonderful procedure for women, and actually improve the health of many. For many women who have larger pendulous breasts, they have problems with sports activities and other kinds of things. They get backaches, and many breast reduction can be a really beneficial procedure. And then also for men, many men have a larger feminine type breast almost, and they have those reduced through gynecomastia, which is a procedure for men reducing their breasts. And that's becoming more popular.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our first special guest today was Michael Marriott, Executive Director of NIRS, the Nuclear Information Resource Service. The special guest in the second half of the program was Dr. John Connolly, one of the nation's leading experts on cosmetic and plastic surgery. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku for Exploration. Be sure to check out my website. It's mkaku.org, mkaku.org. And my latest book is Physics of the Impossible. Good day.